You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My name is Michael Swain. I'm a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment in the Asia program here. And it's my pleasure to both welcome you all to here, Deputy Secretary Steinberg, and to introduce Deputy Secretary Steinberg. As many of you know, Jim has been in government service for many years prior to his current position as Deputy Secretary of State, which he's held since 2009. He has been in the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, was Deputy National Security Advisor, and was also Chief of Staff in the Department of State and the head of the state's policy planning staff, also the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Analysis in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, in INR. Before that, he was a colleague of mine at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica in the late 80s and early 90s when I first met him. And I should say he's also been a past participant in the project that Carnegie has been running for many years on crisis management and was involved in an exercise that we undertook in 2005. Today, he is going to speak on U.S. policy toward Asia. He's going to speak for about 25 minutes, and after that, we'll have about 15 or so minutes of question and answer. And then, as I say, he'll have to leave promptly at 1:15. So without any further ado, Jim?
Well, it's always good to be back at Carnegie and to be with Michael, who is really one of the most thoughtful analysts on China and a good colleague for, as he mentioned, a very long time. So I'm honored to be here with you. And it's a good time to talk about U.S. policy towards Asia. Of course, when you have a topic like this, you immediately run into important definitional questions as to exactly what we're covering in Asia. But as you'll see, since I'm going to focus today primarily on multilateral issues, it's a variable geometry, as they say. I think it's appropriate to focus on Asia for a couple of reasons right now. First of all, this is a busy season on the Asia agendas. I think this crowd knows well, ranging from the Secretary's recent participation in the ASEAN Regional Forum to Secretary Gates' recent involvement in the ADDM to the upcoming visit of the President to four Asian democracies to the EAS meeting that the Secretary will participate in for the first time for the United States to the APEC leaders meeting in Yokohama. That the President will participate. We're going to see a lot of attention to this area, but it's a region that doesn't lack for attention at high levels of government here every day. And when we think about U.S. policy towards Asia, I think you have to think about it in two different dimensions. First, U.S. policy towards the region and its engagement in the region, and obviously enormously significant given the centrality of the issues of Asia to our own security and prosperity and the importance of the dramatic changes that are taking place and developments that take place in the region for the United States and how we engage in the region. But I think equally important, it's we need to focus on Asia not simply in its regional dimension, but for its global significance. After all, in many ways, the issues that we're dealing with regionally in Asia are a microcosm of the big global issues of our time, whether it ranges from proliferation or energy and climate, global public health and the like. But also, not only is it a microcosm of those issues, but Asia and Asian countries are increasingly influential on the global stage in how we address those issues as Asia plays a more prominent role in global institutions and those institutions adapt to accommodate the growing importance of Asian countries. And third, because as a practical matter, the solution to most of the big global challenges requires significant cooperation and engagement by Asian countries. We're not going to solve climate change without an active engagement by some of the leading and growing emitters. We're not going to deal with problems of food security without dealing with consumers and the like. And so Asia is important as a region, and I'll focus largely on that dimension of it today. But I think it's also important to stress that our the compelling case for a growing U.S. involvement with leading Asian countries is because of its global significance as well as its regional significance. And I think it's been very clear from the outset of the administration that we've seen this as a central part of our overall foreign policy strategy, that we recognize that we simply can't achieve any of the major objectives that the President and the Secretary have set out without a deepened engagement in Asia. And as Secretary Clinton herself has said, the United States has a strong interest in continuing its tradition of economic and strategic leadership, and Asia has a strong interest in the United States remaining a dynamic economic partner and a stabilizing military influence. Now, when we think about how we engage in Asia, the Secretary and others have talked about three dimensions to our overall strategy, beginning in the first instance with strengthening and revitalizing our core traditional alliances in Asia with Japan and South Korea, Australia, Thailand, and the Philippines. Second, building new and productive relationships with emerging powers in the region. And finally, strengthening multilateral and regional cooperation. In a couple of recent speeches that I've given, I've talked a lot about the first two pillars, both strengthening our alliances and dealing with emerging powers. So I want to focus in my remarks today on the third dimension of our strategy, which is the multilateral and regional dimension. And I think it is quite critically important because while bilateral relationships are important elements of this, we're seeing more and more that the ability to generate cooperation requires the kinds of institutions and informal arrangements that exist around the globe, but are particularly in a process of evolution and development in Asia. And as I said, given the events, upcoming events, including the East Asia Summit and the APEC Summit, it's a good time to reflect on these. I want to start with APEC. It's the one that we tend to spend perhaps less time talking about, but I think it's important to reflect on the continued importance and significance of APEC to our national strategy, as well as a way in which the countries of the Asia-Pacific region interact with each other to develop what we see as a 21st century economic agenda for the region, which also has broader implications for the global economic agenda. And I think that there are a number of important elements of this that will be on display both in the upcoming APEC summit in Yokohama, but fortuitously in what we call the 1-2 punch of the Japanese APEC chair, followed by our own leadership in APEC the following year with the APEC summit upcoming in Honolulu. And I think that if you look at the core issues of our time, whether it's sustainable economic growth, creating jobs, or developing clean and sustainable models for growth and development, APEC has an enormous opportunity to contribute this, not only because of the central role that the region plays in global trade and investment, but also because the ability to develop models of sustainable economic growth critically depends on how growing and developing powers can chart an economic strategy that's consistent with the health of our planet. APEC has an important role to play in so many different elements of this dimension. APEC is a forum. It's an informal forum. It's not largely a kind of institutional decision-making body, but it provides the kind of leadership and innovation that allows us to translate the work that takes place within the various working groups and discussions in APEC to more formal institutions. In effect, it helps push the envelope on economic integration by discussing trade and investment barriers and developing concrete ways for the countries of the region to work together to create win-win solutions on the economic front. The key to making this work is a strategy that focuses on growth that's balanced, inclusive, sustainable, innovative, knowledge-based, and secure. That's a lot of adjectives, but it really demonstrates that there are multiple dimensions to a sound long-term economic strategy, and one of the advantages of APEC is it allows us to see and explore the interconnections between these different elements of our long-term economic strategy. APEC also provides an umbrella and a framework for initiatives to take place that may not involve all of its members but can help provide an impetus to more formal arrangements. And one particularly important example of that is the ongoing discussions on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is an example of how the building blocks created by APEC initiatives can positively shape the regional trade liberalization efforts and potentially be catapulted to even a broader level. The TTP negotiators, as they've begun their very productive work to date, have looked to APEC's work to inform their own efforts on how to make TPP a high-quality trade agreement. And it's a promising model as we try to think about the longer-term vision of a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific. Now, at the APEC meeting, there are a number of important developments to look forward to. For one, it's a chance to look back on how far we've come since the visionary statements coming out of the Bogor Summit 16 years ago, and to see what progress we've made towards achieving the Bogor goals of free trade in the region, as well as cataloging the challenges that remain and giving us a blueprint and an agenda for the way forward. And it will also, as I say, provide a springboard for our own chairmanship of APEC in 2011, when America's first Pacific president will host a conclave that will focus on the importance of these trade and economic ties to the region. I next want to turn to U.S.-ASEAN relations. As you know, from the beginning of our administration, we've seen a strengthened commitment to our engagement with ASEAN as critical to our long-term engagement in East Asia. And nothing illustrates that more clearly than the meeting that the president just held with ASEAN leaders in New York in the margins of UNGA, as well as the secretary's the two secretaries' participation in Asian-led meetings over the past few weeks. I think as ASEAN has developed, so too has our partnership developed, and we've seen an ever-growing catalog and agenda of issues of common interest and concern and an ability to work together on common strategic goals. ASEAN is an indispensable partner for the United States. It's critical to the issues that I've talked about up till now, things like climate change and economic growth, as well as dealing with some of the new and emerging security concerns like piracy and freedom of navigation, all of which are central to ASEAN's future and in which the United States are critical partners. As I said, we've deepened our engagement not only with these individual meetings that I've identified, but also by the decision to name a U.S. ambassador to ASEAN separate from our national representation in the region, as shows the significance that we attach to ASEAN as an organization as well as its individual members. And similarly with our decision last year to accede to ASEAN's Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, which is another example of the importance that we attach to the frameworks that ASEAN is developing for a peaceful and stable region. And it's in part because of the importance that we attach to ASEAN as a focal point for developing cooperative strategies in East Asia that we have decided to move forward to deepen our engagement and participation in the East Asia Summit. We believe that the creation of the East Asia Summit is really a transformative development in the evolution of the regional architecture in East Asia. We also recognize that Asia has its own ways and its own dynamics, and you can't point to any other specific organization or institution as a model. This is something that we're going to have to develop to meet the unique challenges of Asia. But what's of particular importance from our perspective is that the ASEAN Summit and its membership really reflects what we believe is the key political geography of East Asia going forward. It comprises all the key players of the region, and in particular importance and very much highlighted by the president's trip, including India, as well as Russia now coming in as a member along with us. And the fact that ASEAN is at the center allows the institution to develop in ways that avoids the danger of this being seen as a rivalry among the larger powers in the region, but allows us actually to have a framework that can promote cooperation and innovative solutions to problems. We recognize that this is an evolutionary process and that we'll have to feel our way forward in terms of the scope of the remit. But this is an opportunity for the leaders of the key countries to think about how to strengthen cooperation on virtually every issue which affects the well-being of the countries of the region, because we all recognize that we need greater rather than less cooperation. And our goal in this is to be a good partner to ASEAN and the other countries in the region in this evolutionary process of institution building. But in addition to these more high-profile regional cooperative mechanisms. We also have what some in my building have so euphoniously called mini-lateralism. I hope that's not one that catches on, but there you have it. An example is our Lower Mekong Initiative, the so-called LMI, which brings together the countries of Southeast Asia who are knit together by the Mekong and the issues that unite them as well as their proximity. And issues like environment, health, education, and infrastructure development allows a subset of the countries of the region to work together on common challenges and provide a framework for cooperation. This was launched by Secretary Clinton last year. It involves Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam. The projects include the Sister River Partnerships between the Mekong and the Mississippi River Commissions, the Lower Mekong Initiative Conference on Transnational Cooperation to Respond to Infectious Disease Threats, and Forecast Mekong. Very practical dimensions of working together for the well-being of our people. We also intend to initiate a program on emerging pandemic threats in the region. We're going to launch a 3-year program to address the impact of climate change on water resources, food, security, and livelihood. Another example of this sub-regional cooperation is our trilateral security dialogue with the United States, Australia, and Japan, which I had an opportunity to participate in just a few weeks ago in Japan. But it allows us to come together at various working levels on an informal basis to focus on areas of both strategic and practical cooperation. Now, as I said, these are the regional organizations, but I don't want to conclude without referencing the increasing role that Asia plays in the broader global institutions. From the membership of the G20 to the discussions of rebalancing in the IMF to the role that the Asian countries played in Copenhagen and will play in the upcoming Cancun discussions on climate to issues like the Proliferation Security Initiative, Asian countries are increasingly critical players to meeting these global challenges and playing an increasingly central role in these global institutions. And so our partnership as we deepen our partnership with the countries of the region, it benefits not only our regional agenda, but our global agenda as well. So with that, let me pause, and I look forward to your questions and comments.
Great. Excellent. Thanks, Jim. Well, we have then a little bit extra time.
Michael or Stan?
Whatever you please. Sit's okay. We have then about 20 minutes plus of time for Q&A, and I would like to use a prerogative of the chair, if I may, to open this up with one sort of basic question, I guess, which tries to encompass the issue of how multilateral organizations can address security questions in the region. And the specific issue, I guess, for me is, how do you see the relationship between multilateral organizations from a security perspective, and particularly ones that are being promoted now that are based on political systems, democratic systems? You have some arguments out there that say there need to be a greater level of democracy-based association among different countries in the region, U.S., Japan, India, Australia, South Korea, etc., and that these should really engage on security issues. And then, of course, the counter-argument is you really need to have something more inclusive that certainly includes China, and that is a much more productive way to proceed in addressing security issues. How do you look at that sort of potential, at least, tension between those two different approaches?
Yeah, it won't surprise you, Michael, that I don't see a tension between the two. I think they're complementary and both are necessary. As I mentioned in my remarks, we have mechanisms like the Trilateral Security Dialogue with the U.S., Japan, and Australia, which is clearly a like-minded engagement of countries with both shared political values as well as shared security interests. But we're also developing broader regional structures, whether it's the six-party talks format for North Korea nuclear issues or the ASEAN Regional Forum and EAS more broadly. And I think both are necessary. I think it is important. And historically, the United States has had a special set of relationships of trying to develop common strategies and common positions with like-minded friends and allies, and we need to sustain that. And as I mentioned, at the core of our strategy towards Asia, we begin with those bilateral traditional relationships. But we also recognize that we if it were only issues among the like-minded, we wouldn't have nearly as many problems as we do when there are differences of perspective. So we need institutions and arrangements to encompass that. So that's one of the areas where there's a multiple kind of strategy, but it's also we need a balance between more and less formal institutions as well. There are some times in which we need just the opportunity for people to get together without the formalities of secretariats and voting rules, but there are also other times in which it may be useful to have more formal, more binding type mechanisms. And I think that's part of the evolutionary approach that's taking place within East Asia. We can draw on models from other regions because there's a lot of institutional innovation going on around the world, whether it's the process of reform of the OAS in this hemisphere, whether it's the evolution of the AU in Africa, whether it's the work we're doing now both to revitalize NATO and also to strengthen the OSCE with its upcoming summit in Astana in a few weeks. We can learn from other regions, but there will inevitably be a uniquely Asian character to the choices that we make in this region.
Thank you. Okay, let's open up to the audience for questions then. And there are also people seated in the other room in the back, and I think there's going to be – are there or no? No? Okay. Otherwise, we'd have cards. So when I call on you, can you please identify who you are and keep your question relatively brief? Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Yes, gentleman right there with your hand up. Can you – there's going to be a microphone. Sorry.
No problem. Arshad Mohammed of Reuters. As I'm sure you saw this morning, China released its third quarter foreign exchange reserve figures. They rose to $2.65 trillion in the third quarter, and that was up $194 billion in the course of the quarter, single largest increase in history for their reserves. Does that not suggest to you that the imbalances are getting worse, not better, notwithstanding China's decision in June to untether itself from its peg?
Arshad, as you well know, we have a good understanding with our Treasury colleagues as who's going to talk about which issues, and that's one they're going to talk about. So I would refer to them on that.
Pass. Yes, sir. Gentleman back there. And then.
Thank you very much. Raghubir Goel, India Global Nation Today. Mr. Secretary, can you just a little bit talk about President's visit to India, sir, and what are we expecting as far as both sides, what U.S. is asking India or what India is asking? I mean, so much is going on between the two countries, and there is so much preparation going on in India as far as his visit is concerned.
Well, I'm not going to steal the President's thunder on the specifics of this trip, but I will say that this is going to be a very, very significant trip, I think, for both countries and in the evolution of our relationship. As you know, from the beginning of this administration, we've placed particular importance on strengthening and broadening our relationship with India. And it was no coincidence that the first state visit that the President hosted was for Prime Minister Singh. And since that time, the level of engagement has grown just exponentially. I myself have had an opportunity to visit India. We've had lots of meetings of senior Indian officials here. The National Security Advisor was just here and met with all of us a few weeks ago. On the economic, political, and social level, our agenda is very, very broad. And what you're going to see in this visit is a demonstration of just how broad that relationship is, that we have important work to do on the economic front, on the security front, on the political front, on regional issues, on issues of food security and agriculture, on education. The list goes on and on. And I think what we will be able to demonstrate is that we really have moved to a qualitatively new level in this relationship, one that's based on mutual respect and appreciation for the growing and constructive role that India does and can play on the international scene. And that partnership, I think, will be very much in view. I think the other thing just to note, as I suggested here, is that although in our lexicon at the State Department, we group India and South Asia, we also see India very much as an East Asian country as well. And in some ways, the stop in India will be the first stop on the President's East Asian tour. And we've been one of the important factors for us in seeing the East Asian Summit as a forum for developing cooperation within the region is the fact that India is a participant there. So I think this really reflects a bilateral, regional, and global partnership between the United States and India, and I think we're going to be able to demonstrate that we're able to put behind us some of the differences of the past, find constructive and innovative ways to move forward to build this relationship that will be a very of demonstrable benefit to the people of India and the United States as well as the world. Our economic futures can only be strengthened. We have great opportunities there. Our political cooperation, our dealing with the needs of our people on health, on food and the like, are all things that we both, I think, believe we can take to a new level, and I think that will be very much highlighted on the trip.
Thank you. Ma'am.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Paula Stern, and have the privilege of being on the Secretary of State's International Economic Policy Advisory Committee, and I want to ask you a question about trade, not about the exchange rate. So I hope this still, you're not going to send that one over to Ron Kirk or Geithner. Because when it comes to the rebalancing, which you talked about, between the major economies, U.S. and China in particular, but all of them, Japan most prominently, subsidies have crept in. During the whole effort to stimulate in this us out of this global recession that we've been in. And we have petitions now about the way China operates its economic systems that may go up against some of the rules of the road of the World Trade Organization, of which they're a member. And I note there are also observers at the OECD where there are also kind of principles of standards of rules of the road. So my question is the extent to which APEC, in its visions, will deepen some of these issues beyond the exchange rate questions and really get into the models that are appropriate for a global architecture?
Well, Paul, it's a great question. And although I can't comment, obviously, on specific cases, I would make two general observations. One, you've pointed your finger at something where we believe APEC can have a particularly important role, which is to develop models of institutional reform to limit non-tariff barriers, to deal with some of the regulatory issues that stand in the way of trade and economic growth, to look at some of these sort of structural problems, and to use APEC as a place for countries to showcase their own reform efforts to try to deal with these elements and to have a chance for give and take in an informal way among member countries to explore areas of concern, of structural areas of concern on all sides. It's a nice complement to the more formal mechanisms of the WTO. And obviously, you know, we believe strongly that the reason we signed up and joined the WTO was to give a fair and law-based forum for us to dispute these issues. When we bring WTO cases, it's not a political act. It's simply using the mechanisms that we've all agreed to achieve the results we've all agreed we should be achieving, which is a rules-based open trading system. But that complementarity, that sort of structural work that can go on in APEC, whether it's on facilitation, whether it's reducing barriers, whether it's looking at models of structural reform to reduce the imbalances and the inefficiencies that come with these kinds of interventions, I think APEC is a very attractive forum for that to take place, precisely because it's not a decisional body, but it does allow kind of peer engagement to encourage countries to best practices and to take the advice and concerns of others into account.
Well, if I might just point out the subsidies issue, which I don't know it's necessarily been a focal point anywhere, including the WTO, until a dispute comes, you know, at the end of the day. There's some proactivity that could be done at all of those economic and trade institutions of which we are members, and so are China. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, right there.
Tasey Schaefer from CSIS. I wanted to pick up on something you said in response to a previous question about India and how the administration sees India very much as a part of the Asian fabric. And this is consistent with things that the administration's been saying really for the past year. Does that lead you to rethink what we believe should be India's role in
East Asia-centric institutions? I'm thinking in particular of APEC.
Well, I think with respect to APEC, as you know, there has been a freeze, moratorium, whatever the right word is, on new membership issues. And I think we've all recognized that with the end of this year, that we're time to think about that and to think about sort of what the future of APEC is. And I think sort of decisions on membership need to be embedded in that broader conversation with the membership. But I do think that it's apparent that on the economic front, as on the political front, that India itself is looking east, that it's developing stronger trade and economic ties, well, north and east, I suppose, and that that therefore we need to think about how we relate India's economic development to the region. And that will be part of the overall review process as the countries of the region, of the membership of APEC, moves past this period of pause to consider whether and in what direction we should move.
Thank you. Yes, right up here.
Vincent Yao from Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative Office. With the decision of U.S. participation in the East Asia Summit, we have heard more discussion about the likelihood of the Obama administration using APEC to deal with, in the future, to deal with economic issues and EAS to deal with political issues. Do you think this is a policy of the administration right now, or whether or not it will become a policy in the future?
Well, as I mentioned in my remarks, I mean, as we work through the evolution of these institutions, we want to be seen as a good partner, and therefore we want to have these conversations among the members. I think there's always a temptation to sort of develop the answer in Washington and then tell our partners about it rather than have a discussion with them. And so we're obviously beginning to develop some ideas about how we see the future of all of these institutions. But rather than sort of announce that this is what we think it should be, we want to consult with others. And I think particularly as the newest members of EAS, it would be a bit presumptuous of us to come in and say, well, here's where we think the organization should go. So I think there'll be an opportunity with the Secretary's trip to Hanoi to begin those discussions. It's obviously part of our bilateral diplomacy when we meet with other partners who are in the EAS to get their views. We're particularly sensitive to the central role that ASEAN plays and want to solicit the views of our ASEAN partners about their own views about the EAS and the relationship between the EAS. And that's part of the reason, just going back to Tezi's question, even on the membership issue, this is something that we don't want to sort of say, well, here's the Washington answer. We want to begin these discussions with our partners. We clearly do need to sort these things out. It doesn't have to be done overnight. And as we've learned in many other regions, there doesn't have to be a bright line between each and every institution. Things don't kind of follow those neat org charts in the real world as they do sometimes in the classroom. And that because these are evolutionary developments, they have to take into account a variety of perspectives. So this is a dialogue that we're beginning, particularly with EAS, as I say, just coming into it. We want to consult with others and get their perspective and try to figure out where are the gaps, where are the areas where cooperation needs to be extended, where are we not able to work together in the region as effectively as we want, where are the potential duplications and how might we resolve those.
Great. Way in the back there. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Sam Kim from Voice of America. I want to ask you on North Korea. U.S. and allies in the region demand North Korea to recommit its denuclearization commitment in 2005 agreement. But North Korea's recent action and statements are showing different position. Most recently, North Korean diplomat said that they're not going to come back to the NPT as a non-nuclear state. And there is also concern that if there is no dialogue, North Korea would be heading to the further provocation. And there is also doubt that about a real impact of U.S. sanction and multilateral effort to persuade North Korea. So can I ask you a comment on these concerns? Thanks.
Well, since everybody in this room, one form or another, has probably had to deal with the North Korea issue at some point or another, I think we've all learned that I don't think there's a lot of value in responding to specific public statements made by press speak for North Korea. We'll see in the event what the policies and the decisions are of the North Korean leadership. But I would simply say that the North Koreans continue to insist that they do support and agree on the implementation of the 2005 statement, so that ought to provide a good basis to move forward. But based on the past history, we still need some clear indication that the North is prepared to go beyond rhetoric to actual deeds to reflect that implementation. We believe it's strongly in their interest. We think there's a strong consensus among the other five countries in the six-party talks that North Korea needs to demonstrate its seriousness of purpose to make resumption of the talks meaningful and useful. And we are very open to see the kinds of ideas that the North has about how to resume that process. We've always believed a diplomatic solution would be desirable and that there's much in it for all concerned. But the North has to understand, given its past actions, that there's some skepticism and therefore there's some responsibility on their part to show that they are serious about the joint statement and that they really do want to pursue that path.
Great. Stanley.
Stanley Roth, Boeing. I applaud you for taking this approach on regional and global, which is so rarely brought into the equation given all the bilateral issues that are hot enough in Asia. And I want to stick with your theme. And obviously, we've already shown, I think the administration has shown through the Secretary's comments in Hanoi, that multilateral institutions that were downgraded in the past and called talk fest can have a major impact on security issues. And now coming into the EAS with the Secretary this year, the President next year, that suggests even a greater venue. But I think you'd also agree that ultimately, you know, the metric is going to be results. You know, what do these organizations accomplish, particularly in the political security fields? So I'd like to ask you, with the defense ministers meeting just going on, EAS coming up, what would you consider success for this round, you know, on the whole panoply of maritime security issues? What do you think can be accomplished in these regional venues?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen, as you suggested, some models in the past. And so, for example, the Declaration on Conduct with respect to the South China Sea, in our view, was a very positive way in which, in an informal and a kind of a non-binding way, countries can begin to develop some norms and some understandings about practice. And we think that the whole area of freedom of navigation is one in which everyone agrees is a common interest. That is a shared view, and you heard this from the Chinese representation at the ADDM as well as Secretary Gates. So I think we're obviously going to begin with the areas where there's more common ground than less to build up a sense of success, of achievement, whether it's dealing with common efforts on piracy, where all the countries in the region have an interest. And while we've focused a lot on the Gulf of Aden in recent years because of the intensity of the Somali piracy, there are piracy issues in the Straits of Malacca and in the region as well. And there are other issues of environmental safety in the region with the increase of maritime traffic. We even have an interest in discussing some of the issues that have other sea routes, like through the Arctic, which would potentially be significant for Northeast Asia in particular going forward. So that may be another area where things could be discussed. I think that there is, as I say, there's an opportunity to begin with areas where there's a shared sense of what the objective is and a need to figure out mechanisms for strengthening the ways in which we coordinate, collaborate, and the like. Again, you know, PSI is an example. Some of the environmental issues are examples. And that those are places to start while we then look over time to address some of the more thorny ones. I mean, we clearly are a long way away from the kind of rich multilateral arrangements like arms control in Europe. That's not, you know, on the near term of the agenda, but it's not out of the question for a long time in the future. So we want to start with places where we can make pragmatic improvements, find areas of clear shared interest, and demonstrate that we can work together effectively. Natural disasters, of course, disasters at sea, another example of shared interest where coordination, developing mechanisms for communication, cooperation are all clearly in all countries' interest and which these kinds of multilateral arrangements can facilitate.
Jim, if I could just follow up one point on this. If you could make the argument that the recent discussions that occurred in Hanoi, both at the ARF meeting that was attended by Secretary Clinton and most recently with Secretary Gates, that the United States sent a signal that, in fact, it wants to work with, or you could say use, the ARF as indeed a way of discussing some of the really sensitive issues, which would be territorial disputes in the South China Sea, as a forum, and that is in some ways a kind of a new departure for the United States to introduce that issue in that way into that kind of a forum, and it certainly generated at least some potential tension with the Chinese on this issue, which was very clear at the event itself in the case of the ARF. What's your sense about that?
Well, I guess what I would distinguish, Michael, just to, as the complementarity of yours and Stanley's point, is that when Stanley's talking about results, I mean, I do think, obviously, that on the more difficult and more sensitive issues, we don't see this as necessarily using the forum to get an agreement, but simply to have an opportunity for exchange of views and better understanding. And I think one of the things we do hope for the EAS, whatever its substantive remit, is that it becomes sufficiently informal and flexible that leaders can discuss issues of concern and that it's seen as appropriate and not threatening to have these issues raised. But at the same time, if we're talking about results, I mean, I don't think we expect that these are necessarily going to translate into these institutions becoming decision-taking institutions on difficult issues, at least in their early stages, that what they need to focus on is building trust, cooperation, and patterns of collaboration that will allow this to make us more effective in dealing with the harder ones.
I think we're really coming down to last question. One last question. I want it to be very succinct, please. Ma'am. And then Jim will have to go.
Hi, my name is Ayumi from TV Asahi Japanese TV Station. Good to see you again. Regarding your meeting with you and Japanese Vice Foreign Minister Sasai yesterday, what did you discuss on the U.S.-Japan alliance as well as the upcoming meeting with President Obama and Prime Minister Khan? Thank you.
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, it was a great pleasure to welcome Vice Minister Sasai, an old friend and a good friend of the United States. And I think it's a reflection of the strong relationship between the two countries that we have, you know, people on both sides who worked together for a long time, who know each other well, and have a very strong a sense of mutual commitment to working in the relationship. And he, in support of his boss, the new foreign minister, Maihar, whom we have such high respect for, and on behalf of Secretary Clinton, our goal is to help support the work that they are doing together, and particularly not only in strengthening the bilateral relationship, and we talked a lot about how we can make sure that we communicate effectively to our publics the long-term strategic perspective of our bilateral relationship, but also to make these series of upcoming meetings a success. And one of the ways that we make it a success is really to focus on the broad range of shared interests and cooperation that we have and our joint determination to tackle those challenges. We have no more important partner in Asia than Japan. We have a very, very strong security relationship. We also want to find ways to strengthen the economic relationship, and we talked about avenues and dimensions of that as well. So, I mean, I think we feel that the bonds and the partnership is very strong, and one of our key challenges is not only to build on that momentum, but also to do an effective job of communicating to the publics just how relevant and vital that relationship remains today.
Great. And with that, we'll have to bring this meeting to an end. Please join me in thanking Secretary Steinberg for coming over today and speaking to us.